Chapter 4, The Emotional Game of Opportunity. Opportunity Shock. Alvin Toffler wrote a book titled Future Shock, which introduced the idea that too much change happening too quickly can leave people feeling disoriented and in a state of shock. He introduced the term information overwhelm. Al Reese and Jack Trout wrote in their book Positioning that we are the world's first overcommunicated society. There is too much communication happening for us to be able to take it all in and understand it. Future Shock was written in 1970. Positioning was written in 1980. These issues are only going to get more intense. As we transition into the 2020s, we will be entering the area of opportunity shock. Ray Kurzweil and Peter Diamandis, two futurists, point out that we carry more knowledge and potential power in our mobile devices than was available to a king or president 50 years ago. They show how our access to tools and resources is increasing as their cost decreases, and they predict that we will enter an age of unimaginable abundance as machines automate the monotonous drudgery of life, freeing us to express ourselves creatively and enjoy lives of leisure and happiness. That is likely to be a good thing for many people and for many societies. But all this opportunity also has a shadow aspect. Access to abundant resources also brings with it a mathematical puzzle of exponentially increasing difficulty. As your opportunities multiply in quantity and quality, how do you decide which ones are right for you? We will each have so much opportunity individually with our businesses and in our organizations and in social domains of family, friends, and politics that it will be shocking to our systems. This shock will manifest as moments of dazed confusion where we find ourselves zoning out in a trance of distraction, overwhelmed by opportunity and choice. Let's say that you have an opportunity for a business project that you will personally enjoy and learn a lot from, and that has a 50% chance of paying you $100,000 in 1 year. Alternately, you could do a business project that you will enjoy half as much, learn half as much from, and that has a 25% chance of paying you $1 million in 2 years. Which one do you select? What other factors do you take into consideration? Or let's say that you have 1 year's income saved up and you want to invest it. You can invest it in something that you are knowledgeable about, where you feel confident that the investment will grow over time, or you can invest it in something that you have much less knowledge about, where you feel less confident that it will grow in value, but that will force you to learn something new and important for your future. Which do you choose? These aren't just hypotheticals. You probably already face these sorts of complex decisions all the time on a smaller scale. Recently, I was writing down a big insight that was coming to me, and I heard the patter of little feet behind me. My daughter walked up and said, "I'm hungry, Dad." She took my hand and led me away from my computer to the kitchen. These moments when I'm writing down an important idea and my daughter needs something or wants to play bring this dilemma of where to put my attention home for me. I always try to smile in these situations, as this type of opportunity dilemma seems to be happening more and more in life. Lately, I've noticed another pattern. While I'm thinking about a new idea, it triggers a different idea about some other part of my life. I know that if I think about the new thing, I might lose the thread of the original idea, and if I try to write the original one down first, I might forget my new inspiration. And if I go back and forth to try to get both of them down, I can't continue either train of thought. I lose good ideas maybe once every week or two this way. These types of problems are going to increase exponentially in the future. Remember the pond filling with lotuses? And how on day 25, only 3% of the pond is full, but in just 5 more days, it's going to be completely covered? Right now is day 25 across many areas of our lives. Many more options and opportunities are coming. The emotional side of opportunity. As we've learned, opportunity captures your attention in a way that is almost supernatural. When the right convergence of events, ideas, people, and other resources comes together, it can appear as a miraculous synchronicity. We've also learned that too much of a good thing, in this case opportunity, can also be overwhelming and even immobilizing. But as you begin exploring all of the opportunity that is available to you, another thing can start happening. A lot of mixed emotions. As we've learned, we humans come wired with both a mammal, emotional, and social system, and also a reptilian survival and sexual system. One of the consequences of these base layers of our psyches is that the situations we find ourselves in are more and more complex. They require increasingly counterintuitive responses and adaptations in order to cope with and thrive in the face of them. When we are overtaken by an emotional rush, it changes us into a different version of ourselves, often without us even realizing it. When we are really activated or triggered, it can cause us to do something that actually sabotages our long-term success. Let's talk about how to manage our emotions as we learn to surf the wave of opportunity that's coming our way. The cocktail of emotion. At any particular moment, you will likely be feeling a combination of emotions. You might experience a mix of happiness, joy, gratitude, sadness, anger, fear, and possibly others. You may have had a great day at work, but gotten a ticket on the way home, then received a surprise call from an old friend that you enjoyed, then saw that one of your investments was down, then heard that your favorite band is coming to town to play soon, then saw that your romantic partner made an affectionate comment on social media to an ex-flame of theirs. Layers of rising and falling emotions course through our bodies continuously. Feelings are like cocktails. They are combinations of feelings. They are ever-changing and dynamically unpredictable. Let's check in right now with your emotions. To do this, start by tuning in to the physical sensations that you're experiencing inside your body that indicate the presence of emotions. If you haven't done this before, start with this exercise. Can you tune into your senses? Can you feel the surface of your skin? Now, can you feel the interior of your body? Can you feel your hands from the inside? Can you feel your feet from the inside? Can you feel your legs and arms, your torso and head? Can you notice the taste in your mouth and the combination of scents around you? Can you notice what you hear and what you see? Now, can you notice your mind and your thoughts? Can you remember what you did yesterday? And can you imagine what you'll do tomorrow? We have just touched in with the physical body and our senses, and then with the mind and our thoughts. Now, let's tune into our emotions. Can you feel your emotional state? For most people, they can feel a sort of ephemeral set of beyond-the-body sensations that are experienced as emotions. If you're feeling mostly happy, it will have one signature complex of feelings and sensations. If you're feeling mostly sad, it will mean a different set of sensations. If you are feeling joy, it will be another set. If you're angry, it will be yet another. Some people feel joy as a lightness in the chest, or they feel sadness as heaviness or coldness in the body. Some feel anger as heat pulsing over their faces, and some feel love as warmth in the heart area. Emotions seem to arise in our body systems from outside our conscious awareness. It takes effort to tune into and label them. This makes sense if you consider the part that emotions play in holding relationships together and pushing relationships apart, keeping them in a state of dynamic tension. In my experience, emotions control minds and bodies a lot more than minds and bodies control emotions. And emotions are so subtle and stealthy when they take over. They often come with an instant cover story that reframes what's happening as being rational, willful, and chosen. When you're getting angry or defensive with your romantic partner, it's always for a, quote, good reason, unquote, that makes perfect sense to you. But upon reflection later, you may see that the trigger was about something much more primal and animal in nature, and that that good reason you had was a made-up rationalization to protect your own ego from having to wake up and take responsibility for your part in the conflict. If you invest some time noticing and actually feeling your emotions, you can switch on the lights in parts of your experience that are usually almost completely dark. These are your blind spots. This awareness has you observe the process by which the older, more instinctive parts of your psyche assert themselves and influence how you think, communicate, behave, and interact. It's most powerful to notice the internal physical sensation of your emotions because it allows you to process them much better. Once you start learning how to feel your emotions manifest in your body, you can breathe into and help them move through you without getting stuck. Most people, in my experience, do not allow themselves to have complete emotion cycles. If they become upset about something that another person said, they become sad or angry and go into a pattern of complaint or attack, but then never return to feel the sadness and hurt that was activated in the first place. If they feel envy because another person has something they want, or jealousy, this often manifests as aggression, which can trigger a cycle of escalating conflict that distracts from ever going back and feeling the deeper, more relevant feeling that was activated. As you notice your emotional state, try asking yourself these questions. Where exactly are those sensations in your body? Is it below the skin, deep inside your body, or at the surface? What color are the sensations? Are they warm or cold? Do they have texture? Are they moving? In which direction? Do they have a form or shape, or even a personality? As you notice these aspects of your emotional state, you'll also see that your emotions are typically in flux. If you stay with an emotion, especially one that's unpleasant to experience, such as sadness or anger or fear or jealousy or envy, you'll not only get a much better sense of what the emotion is trying to tell you, but you also help the emotion process through your system to completion. Note, if what I'm saying right now is particularly resonating with you and you want to go deeper with this type of work, you may want to look up a somatic therapist who is familiar with multiple therapeutic modalities. I prefer to work with people who know both Western and Eastern methods, who integrate science and intuition to create their own style. Emotions change our thinking and our behavior. When we are under the influence of strong emotions, it essentially changes us into a different person. We all have multiple sub-personalities, and just like the Pixar movie Inside Out shows so brilliantly, when one of these multiple aspects of our personalities takes over, it can have powerful consequences. In a discussion of emotions, it's important to also remember that emotions serve a primarily social function. If you're feeling a strong emotion, it's likely that it is over a relationship with another person or group of people. And because this strong emotion is influencing your perceptions, thinking, decision-making, communication, and actions, and because others are also feeling different types of emotions in the situation, which are influencing their thinking and behavior, there is a sort of higher dynamic that is controlling the interactions. You can imagine a marionette standing over the group, pulling strings on different people emotionally, and conducting the play from another dimension. Shakespeare and other great dramatists had a brilliant, intuitive understanding of these higher patterns and dynamics of human psychological and social drama. In Romeo and Juliet, the juxtaposition of teenagers from enemy families falling in love, navigating through a tragedy of conflict, then ultimately killing themselves, resulting in the families reconciling, puts one on a roller coaster of emotions. But it also reveals underlying human social dynamics in a way that no real story could. By recognizing these mythological meta patterns, timeless storylines, and recurring human dramas, we can start to see how each emotion we feel is a puzzle piece in a bigger puzzle. Itself, just another iteration of an infinite variety of similar narratives being played out through the history of the world. Emotions play a big role in how you relate to and interact with the opportunity in your life. And getting in tune with some of the emotional dynamics that you'll encounter as you discover and design opportunities is important to the process of development in this area. I mentioned that emotions are primarily a social phenomena. They tend to be strongest and most influential when other people and groups are involved. Because the other people are also very interested in pursuing opportunity, this creates a very high probability that strong emotions will be triggered as you interact in social dynamics with others around it. Envy. It's an interesting experience to be in the presence of someone who has already achieved the thing you want in life, or someone who is a master of a domain that you would like to master yourself. For me, it often feels like an interesting cocktail of awe, admiration, excitement, anxiety, and self-consciousness, combined with coveting and wanting what they have, which is envy. If you are going to master opportunity, it will require you to spend more and more time around people who are increasingly successful. I can remember the first time I saw Joe Stumpf, a coach and real estate teacher, on stage. I was 22 years old and had just gone into real estate in Eugene, Oregon. He did a free half-day seminar at a local hotel conference room. I was trying to understand sales and marketing at the time, and he was probably the most charismatic person I had ever seen. I can still remember feeling a rush of excitement because I was learning something that felt like it was going to change my life, while at the same time feeling envy and self-consciousness because I wanted that kind of success and didn't know how to get it. I can also remember the first time seeing the visual art of Android Jones at Burning Man. I had never seen anything like it. The sophisticated digital style was so alien to me that I was both attracted and somewhat confused by it at the same time. The more I looked at it, the more I realized that I was in the presence of something new and important. I could not believe that someone could layer in so many different ways of looking at reality into one picture. I was seeing everything in new ways, and this created a feeling of excitement, anxiety, and curiosity. I was also overcome by the desire to have a piece of this art on my wall. As I've gotten to know Android over the last several years, I am continually floored by his ability to create visual masterpieces, and I feel envy because no matter how hard I try, I can only accomplish a tiny fraction of what he can visually. I can remember the night I fell in love with my wife. We were having a conversation about mathematics, philosophy, and culture, and she started comparing the personalities of different cultures to each other while referencing abstract mathematics. And I was in awe of her. She was using terms like fractal and holographic and referencing Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Very sexy. But along with the feeling of awe and appreciation, I also felt other feelings in these situations. Pangs of fear, shame, envy, and discouragement. It has only been through the process of exploring my emotions that I've learned emotions are never pure. We are always carrying the mixed cocktail of emotions in our systems, some designed to get us to move away from certain things, some designed to get us to move towards certain things, some that trigger certain thoughts, and some that repress other thoughts. As I become more sensitive to my own emotions, I notice that I experience at least a little bit of envy every time I hear about someone who's more successful in a domain that I'm working on. Sometimes I even experience it when I see someone doing something I'll never want to learn how to do. If you're going to master opportunity in your life, it's important to get real about what's actually happening in your body, emotions, and mind so you can work with it. I have watched people who became completely immobilized by envy, who were so green with envy that they couldn't function in their normal lives. If you find yourself experiencing envy, try this approach that I learned from author and motivational speaker T. Harv Eker. In one of his seminars, he recommended a blessing that he learned from the Hawaiian Huna tradition. It goes like this: bless that which you want. The idea is that if you see someone who has achieved success in the domain you're pursuing, say, bless you. When you bless that which you want, you remember that it's a positive thing that the other person has achieved this success. Another approach is to remember the power of social influences. When you can see a person with your own eyes who has achieved something that you would like to achieve, it becomes instantly more possible for you. People thought it was impossible to run a mile in under 4 minutes until Roger Bannister did it in 1954. Then almost immediately, another person ran a 4-minute mile. Then soon after, three people ran a mile in under 4 minutes, all in one race. If you were a runner at that time, you likely would have envied Roger Bannister when you saw him finish in under 4 minutes. But if you realized that it was possible because you knew about a real person who did it, another part of your unconscious mind would have also been saying to yourself, oh, this is possible. Maybe I can do this. So if you see someone who is highly successful doing something you want to do, or who discovered or created an opportunity before you, bless them. And remember that they have just shown you proof that it's possible. They have saved you a lot of time, and you can use them as a positive role model. Even if they had an advantage that you don't have, bless them and appreciate them. And as you become more successful in life, remember that your success will trigger envy in others. One of the reasons why it is important to be grateful for your good fortune and to remain humble is to prevent the suffering that goes along with the feeling of envy for others. Showing off, bragging, and broadcasting your success unnecessarily might feel good to the ego, but it doesn't feel good on others' egos. And in the long run, it's not the way to build a good reputation and a happy life, or to attract good people to your social and business circles. Even as you learn to integrate your own envy, avoid unconsciously or consciously doing things that trigger it in others. the fear instinct. Opportunity and fear go hand in hand. As you discover and develop more opportunities in life, you will see that there are risks and sometimes dangers involved. It's useful to get to know your fear better so you may dance rather than fight with it. All mammals, including humans, are programmed by evolution to feel fear when confronted with certain stimuli. We respond in certain ways to keep ourselves safe, to live another day and reproduce. What's important to know about fear is that it completely changes how you perceive the world. It also changes how you perceive your own thoughts and ideas and how you perceive yourself. Fear tends to trigger us to do things that worked in the past to help us avoid loss or death. Fear does this instinctively without engaging our rational minds. In fact, it short-circuits our rationality and shuts it down. When we're scared, we tend to act first and think later. If we think at all when afraid, it tends to be a particular type of thought, imagining what could go wrong. This catastrophizing tends to amplify the fear and our tendency to act on instinct. Instead of reflective and considered thought, we revert to programmed actions that have worked in the past. If it's dark and we hear a noise, we might duck and hide because this was the best way our ancestors knew to avoid hungry predators that prowl at night. This is an automated adaptation we carry inside of us, a sequence of perceiving a situation and then an impulse to do something in response that has little to do with our conscious mind, which knows that there are no lions in our bedroom. What's important to note about this pattern is that it compels you to avoid novelty and experimentation. Fear increases our aversion to risk. It activates a conservative avoid loss strategy. And if you want to avoid loss, the safest bet is to do what has worked in the past. But as we're learning, the future we are rapidly transitioning into is increasingly novel and requires us to use not only tried and true approaches, but also new and innovative ones. Fear can be an impediment to thriving in this future. If you find yourself in a situation that triggers fear, but that also requires a novel approach, you'll be less likely to discover that approach or even be aware of it. Fear blinds us to opportunity in this way. When we are fearful, the very meaning of opportunity changes. The understanding of opportunity that we're learning and developing here disappears. It becomes invisible. When we're afraid, the only opportunities we can see are the ones that involve preserving the status quo, staying safe, and avoiding loss. Fear and cognitive biases. Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman and his research partner Amos Tversky ran a series of experiments seeking to understand how people behave when faced with choices related to risk and return. If you say to someone, "I'm going to flip a coin, and if it comes up tails, you lose $100. How much would you have to win if it comes up heads in order to take this gamble? Most people respond that they need to win at least $200 to take the bet. In other words, most people will not take a risk unless their potential gain is double the potential loss. If you do the math on this one, you realize that you should take the bet at any amount over $100, as you have the odds in your favor. Let's say that someone offers you $120 if it comes up heads, but you have to pay $100 if it comes up tails. Now imagine doing this exercise 100 times in a row and averaging out the results. If it comes up 50 times heads, you win $6,000. If it comes up 50 times tails, you lose $5,000. At the end of the day, you win $1,000 in this thought experiment. The odds are 10% in your favor, and when situations like this arise in life, we need to go for them and experience the cumulative profit that comes from these incremental wins. This phenomenon scales up and down to any amount of value being considered in any situation in life. If you're saying, "I can't afford to lose $100, that's fine, but we can't afford to lose our lives either, and most of us go out driving on roads at freeway speeds without a second thought. Kahneman and Tversky called this insight that people will do twice as much to avoid losing something as they'll do to get it in the first place, prospect theory. Again, simply stated, it's that people are twice as motivated by loss as they are by gain. This is one of many cognitive biases, the discovery of which have led to a field called behavioral economics that is worth studying at some point for all of us. Some key types of fear to notice are fear of loss, fear of conflict, fear of rejection, fear of the unknown, fear of ambiguity, fear of missing out, fear of death, the mother of all fears. Each has its own subtle character and experience, and each affects us in a particular way, depending on its strength. In his book, Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman explains the process of flooding, where our systems become flooded with chemicals that activate our primitive emotional systems and prepare us to run or fight. If you find yourself flooded with fear, it's important to know you've been pulled into your lower animal mind and not make any long-term decisions, if at all possible. When in fear, we are in pure avoid-loss mode and essentially unable to make good long-term decisions. This is particularly true when it comes to opportunity. You can't make a good decision about opportunity when you're fearful, so don't even try. If you find yourself afraid or activated by strong emotions in general, stop and take a few breaths. Even if you can just stay still a few minutes and wait for that flood of chemicals to subside, it can make a huge difference in the long run. Making the wrong decision, saying the wrong thing, making the wrong commitment can be so expensive. When you're flooded with fear, your mind is hijacked and you're put into a state of impulsive loss avoidance. You are basically thinking the way an animal would be thinking if it was faced with being eaten. Making decisions based on the survival instinct will not get you to your goals or help you become self-actualized. Fear is not a good place from which to assess the long-term value of an opportunity. You become strategically blind when you are fearful. If you find yourself in a fearful state, try this neuro-linguistic programming or NLP technique. Imagine that you're standing behind yourself, looking over your own shoulder at the situation. This is a conscious dissociation exercise, and it can help you step outside of your emotions for a moment, long enough to take a few breaths and get control. Try doing this exercise right now and notice how it shifts your emotional state instantly. Breathing is also particularly helpful. If I find myself in fear, I will often start taking slow, deep breaths, keeping attention on the breath. If thoughts come up, I release them and return to attending to my breath. The combination of the oxygen plus the mindfulness helps me relax and release spikes of fear. What else should be done if you're feeling fearful? The first thing to remember is don't think about the future or make decisions that will impact the future when you are in fear. If you think about the future when you are fearful, you will enter a pessimistic imaginary dystopia where success means not having your nightmares come true. This state is akin to paranoia. The best you will be able to imagine is hanging on to what you currently have. Fear-based imagination is devastating to growth and progress in life. It causes you to make decisions that reduce opportunity in the future. Other tips for responding when you feel fear: deactivate imagination and come into the moment. Stop looking at the signals that are triggering the fear. Go on a data fast immediately. Stop going online. Stop reading news. Engage in a productive activity with other people. FOMO. An interesting manifestation of fear that comes up for many of us is FOMO, or fear of missing out. As I'm writing this book, cryptocurrency has been hitting mainstream consciousness. I've been watching as my friends and family are freaking out over having not invested yet. I'm getting contacted by people I haven't heard from in years asking me if I think they should invest. What all of them have in common is that they have a powerful case of FOMO. They are afraid that they're going to miss out on a big gain and then possibly hate themselves for it later. Fear of missing out is cousin to another psychological emotional state in humans, anticipatory regret. Many of us do not make decisions based on what we want, but instead based on avoiding a potential negative consequence of the decision or action and subsequent regret. Let's say you've been building a business for a year, but then you see others you know successfully launching businesses in other niches. Some of them have become financial winners. You can see they are achieving success much faster than you, and you start to notice a part of yourself saying, maybe you should quit what you're doing and go start one of those other businesses. This is FOMO talking. It's important not to make any rash decisions from this state. When you make a decision based on FOMO, you will definitely not take all of the possible variables into consideration, and your decision ultimately won't be the most strategic, long-term, and beneficial for you. It also looks bad to others. People can sense when you're making a decision out of desperation and FOMO, and they'll respect you less for it. If you find yourself thinking about doing something other than what you're doing because you don't want to miss out on some benefit that others are enjoying, remind yourself that this is what FOMO feels like. In order to master FOMO, as with any emotion, it's important to notice when you're feeling it. Can you remember a time where you experienced the fear of missing out on something? Can you remember the feeling you had about it? See if you can get back in touch with the feeling of that physical, emotional, mental state. Once you have it, notice the inner sensations that it brings up. Tune into the feelings in your body and notice where they are. Feel their texture, pressure, color, movement. Now, say the word FOMO to yourself to anchor the experience to the word. This can help you identify when you're experiencing FOMO in real time in the future so you can be proactive with it. As another exercise, if you are feeling FOMO in the present moment, pause and mentally project yourself to much later in your life. Look back and consider for a moment how many opportunities you're going to miss or pass up. Realize that you're going to be okay if you miss this one, because there are a lot more opportunities coming. Discovery in the light and darkness. In the history of evolution and innovation, nature often solves the same problem in several different ways. This is called convergent evolution. The ability to use light to observe surroundings has come in the form of the eye, which evolved independently in humans, beetles, and spiders, along with dozens of others. So too, the wing for flight has developed in birds, insects, and bats. Human innovation contains examples as well. Calculus was independently invented by Newton and Leibniz at the same time. Evolution was discovered independently by Darwin and Wallace. In science, they call this pattern multiple discovery. I have personally noticed this phenomenon accelerating dramatically with the rise of the internet. When I have an insight about a potential opportunity, I now think to myself, someone else is already thinking about this or will think about this soon. It's going to happen whether I do it or not. I find that this helps me stay closer to a state of equanimity and be less apt to be pulled into a state of possessiveness or obsession if I see that someone else is executing on the idea that I had. It also helps me be more open with my ideas. It's intuitive for some people to be secretive about ideas that they think might be valuable. I have people ask me questions like these regularly. Should I trademark my name or idea before I tell anyone about it? Will you sign this non-disclosure agreement so I can tell you about my idea? How do I prevent people from stealing my digital book or teaching product? This tells me that we're all thinking about these things more and more. Something to keep in mind, each of us has our own unique way of expressing or implementing an idea. I regularly collaborate with my competitors. We speak in each other's courses and programs, we promote for each other, and we advise each other. If you and I work in a similar market or niche and see each other as competitors, we'll feel threatened by each other. We will become overly vigilant and territorial. We might even become suspicious and obsessed. On the other hand, if we see each other as collaborators and we have faith that each of us has our own unique way of doing what we do and that we are better off working together, we can build a relationship and help each other. If I teach you how to write a book and someone else teaches you how to write a book, we are each going to do it very differently. This mindset requires you to remember that most of the time, as long as you are dealing with people who have integrity, that everything will work out. There are going to be times where it doesn't work out, and part of the long-term success game is taking those setbacks, losses, and missed expectations in stride. If you find yourself becoming overly possessive and secretive about ideas you haven't implemented yet, it's probably a signal to relax a little and remember that someone is going to come up with the same idea and likely already has, and that what you really need to do is implement it and see if you can get traction and turn your idea into a successful project rather than worrying about what other people are doing. Jealousy. Of the emotional experiences that abduct us, jealousy is one of the most powerful. Jealousy is typically defined in sexual and romantic terms. It's the experience of being emotionally activated by a fear of abandonment, typically combined with humiliation and anger, because you believe that your love interest might leave you for someone else. When you're under the influence of jealousy, you typically become passively or actively aggressive. This feeling of anger usually masks the underlying fear of abandonment that is the hallmark of jealousy. When someone is jealous, they'll often project their emotions outward, getting upset about something besides the real issue. "She's trying too hard," a woman might say about a perceived rival. "He's an idiot," a man might say about a romantic threat. These statements are typically laced with anger, contempt, or moral indignation. As jealousy usually masquerades as aggression, when a jealous statement is made, the person saying it actually believes in the moment that the anger is the real issue. Jealousy is stealthy. It hides its tracks as it pushes us into becoming a shadow version of ourselves. But jealousy has a unique feel to it, both emotionally as you're experiencing it, and also when you're witnessing someone else feeling it. Once you learn to recognize jealousy, hiding behind the mask of anger, it becomes much more obvious to spot. Can you remember a time in your life when you felt jealousy? Maybe you had a partner who left you for someone else or was cheating on you. Perhaps you were worried that they would leave you, and you became suspicious and obsessed about their communication with others. Can you remember the feeling? Have you ever felt jealousy in a different context? Jealousy extends beyond romantic relationships. You can feel jealous if a good friend of yours becomes better friends with someone else, or if a business partner you were working with on an idea leaves your project to go to work with someone else, or if someone steals the idea that you have and uses it to start a business. It feels very vulnerable to reveal that you're feeling jealous, even to yourself. I suspect our emotional systems are designed to conceal jealousy from our consciousness, as it's too painful to admit it because it feels shameful and degrading to your status. Jealousy starts early and stays with most of us in some form through our lives. My 4-year-old daughter often displays signs of jealousy when I'm hugging my wife, and there's evidence that children feel it starting as early as 6 months old. My daughter will often stop what she's doing, come over to us when we're hugging, and push us apart so she can be in the middle. I can remember when I was maybe 12 or 13 years old, going out for a day to a water park with two friends. At the end of the day, one of them was angry at me for playing with the other one most of the day. It didn't make sense to me at the time, but now I recognize that he was feeling jealous. If it's hard to admit to ourselves when we're jealous, it's even harder to admit to another, especially your partner. It's even worse to be accused of it by them. When a person is in the throes of jealousy, it's essentially impossible to reason with them. They are typically self-deceived into thinking that the issue is something other than jealousy, so you aren't going to be successful trying to talk sense with them. It's actually an interesting learning experience to try to reason with someone who's feeling jealous. Every time you make a good point about something, they only get more upset because it's making them feel more suspicious and possessive. Because they are interpreting everything you are saying through a lens of being threatened, every rationale that you provide only serves to heighten their paranoia. I can remember going on a date with a girlfriend years ago and visiting a nightclub where a male friend worked. We walked in together, and I immediately spotted my friend's girlfriend standing nearby. I walked over to give her a hug, but when my date saw this, she immediately became angry and upset. I asked, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Who's that girl?" I tried explaining that it was my friend's girlfriend, but this seemed only to upset her and make her more suspicious. Have you ever been in a similar situation? It's easy to see it when you look at other people, but much harder to spot when you're the one feeling jealous. If you're feeling jealous, you're under a spell, possessed by this ancient dark animal spirit, and you will likely not know consciously that it's jealousy that is animating your fear, aggression, and imaginings. Remember, we don't tend to think of ourselves as feeling jealous in contexts outside of romantic relationships, but it happens all the time. When you're feeling threatened and possessive, you're typically feeling jealous, even if it's over an idea. If you find yourself fearful and paranoid that you might lose something because someone else will get it first or take it from you, it's possible that jealousy has possessed you. This also means that if you're feeling jealous, you are under a spell, possessed by this ancient animal spirit. And you will likely not know consciously that it's jealousy that's animating your fear, aggression, and imaginings. I was recently having a dialogue with an artist who has been gaining some popularity and who has had his style copied by someone else online. He was upset, and he was investing a lot of time, thought, and energy into trying to protect his style from others copying it. I immediately sensed the presence of jealousy. Competition can activate jealousy. Watch for it when you see a person or business that occurs to you as a potential rival. Again, the signal you're looking for is anger or aggression. You'll become possessed by the thought of possessing something or someone. If you say, "I'm just not a jealous person," that's great. It might also mean that you haven't had something that you really cared about and then were faced with losing it. Keep an open mind, because it just might arise when you have something that you perceive as really important on the line. When jealousy arises, just notice it. Say, "Hello, jealousy," and then do some breathing. Reflect on the thing, person, or idea that you might lose if your worst fear comes true. Make peace with that potential outcome and go to work creating more opportunity in your life. Even treat it as an opportunity in and of itself to figure out how to make that part of your life even better than you might have expected before. I also like to notice that if I'm feeling jealousy, that there's often something to admire about the other person or group that I feel threatened by. If you notice what you admire, then you can get a free lesson in how to upgrade yourself or your project. Try it. If jealousy really seems to have you, then you might want to get some professional help. Some people are more sensitive to these types of emotions, and if you're one of them, that's fine. Just know what you're dealing with and be proactive. There are expert therapists who specialize in helping people who have strong jealousy, and it just might help you to find one. Don't let this powerful emotion abduct your good sense and prevent you from being successful in the long term. The stress of increasing opportunity. Part of the stress that flows from opportunity comes from the sheer choices that we are faced with. As we mentioned earlier, Dr. Barry Schwartz, in his book, The Paradox of Choice, explains that we believe that more choices will make us happier. And up to a point, they do. But past a handful of good choices, we start to experience a decreasing level of happiness and more stress because too many choices overwhelm our judgment systems. The cognitive load is too big when faced with so many choices. There are many ways we could make a choice that we'll regret later or miss the choice that will make us the happiest. Mapping all those permutations can be harrowing. I was just shopping online for a headset to use for calls. I wanted something that plugs directly into the headphone jack on my computer. As I was searching through the options, trying to find something that would work for my needs, I was shocked at how many different types of headsets are available. I spent probably an hour just trying to find a simple headset. In his book, Schwartz explains two strategies for dealing with increasing choice. He calls these maximizing and satisficing. Maximizers look at all their options and then compare them to try to find the very best one. They won't settle for less than the very best. Satisficers use a different approach. They decide what they want, then go look for a solution that will satisfy their needs. If there's something marginally better out there, then so be it. They're not bothered. For example, a maximizer will buy a car by comparing all of the models to each other, test driving all of them, and finding the one with the best features and most options. They will research online and in person to find the very best price. And then, after they buy, they will watch the market to see if something better comes along or the price drops, and feel bad if it does because they missed out. If a satisficer is buying a car, they will consider what they need in a car and make a list of what they care about. Then they will go looking for something that satisfies their needs, and when they find it, they will buy it. They will move on to other things and not worry about whether or not they made the right choice. These are obviously stylized descriptions of idealized types, but you probably recognize yourself in one of the descriptions. And if you're a maximizer, then it's useful for you to know that maximizing is not only a strategy for finding the very best thing at the very best price, but can also be a recipe for dissatisfaction and unhappiness. Satisficing is more than just a technique. It can also become a way of approaching life. It turns out that there are a handful of things in life that lead to a feeling of wellness, happiness, meaning, success, and fulfillment. These are things like enough sleep, daily exercise, balanced meals, time with people we care about, continual learning, thinking positively, and being present in the moment. None of these is revolutionary or sexy, so we tend to miss their importance in life. A big part of the fulfillment game is to allow yourself to be satisfied with something that does what you need it to do, and not to become obsessed with getting the best thing at the best price, being a super parent, looking like you're on the cover of a magazine, or having more money than you need to live a lifestyle that is sufficient for your needs. Maximizing as an approach can really lead us to be overwhelmed by all the options and choices in our lives because each option has slightly different trade-offs and slightly different potential implications. The opportunity you don't need to consider is the one that will create a big positive result that isn't going to contribute to your overall fulfillment with life. If you pursue an opportunity that also stresses you out, makes you feel anxious or worried, puts you in a situation where you're working with people you don't like, changes your values to a configuration that's not right for you, etc., then it's probably not a good opportunity for you. Cool, calm, collected. Dr. Hans Selye, a Hungarian doctor and scientist, noticed that patients who were sick had a type of common appearance. They all looked sick. And he proposed the generalized phenomenon that he called stress. The idea is that when a person experiences sickness, emotional trauma, or external pressure, that we have an overall response that we experience as a feeling of stress on our systems. I think that it's important to understand this generalized experience of feeling stress and to develop the ability to recognize when we're feeling it in real time. The Great Acceleration, while miraculous in its creative power, is also creating more stress in our lives across more dimensions than we have experienced before. Witness the rise in depression, suicide, mass shootings, and general anxiety about the security and safety of life, even while we're enjoying the lowest levels of war and violence in recorded history, along with the biggest growth boom and extension of lifespan. We're living longer, we're more successful, we have access to more amazing technology and knowledge, and yet we're feeling more fear and anxiety about it all. I believe that this is natural because the stakes in life just keep going up, and it's appropriate to feel some level of anxiety when a lot is on the line. One of the reasons why I'm fascinated with the study of opportunity is this paradox of having more and more opportunity in our lives and yet feeling more and more stress as a result. Some of this comes because growth, success, and wealth are not equally distributed in the world, and this triggers much envy, jealousy, and sour grapes. There's a great video of an experiment with capuchin monkeys that caricatures this phenomenon. An experimenter walks up to a pair of cages, each one with a monkey inside. The monkeys can see each other, and they can see what happens next. The experimenter trades one monkey, a grape, for a little rock, which is monkey money, then goes to the other cage, and when the monkey gives her a little rock, she gives the monkey a slice of cucumber instead of a grape. Now, normally, capuchin monkeys love cucumbers and will gladly trade one of their little money rocks for a slice. But in this case, the monkey just watched its neighbor trade its rock for a grape, which monkeys like even more than cucumbers. When the experimenter does the same thing again, trading the first monkey a grape, then moving to the second monkey and offering a cucumber, the monkey becomes angry and throws the cucumber out of the cage. Even a great opportunity can be upsetting if we see others getting better ones that we think are unfair. I like to learn about new domains in life and build skills in areas that are unknown and challenging to me. I can remember when I went into the real estate business in my early 20s. I often felt a sense of envy when people would call my broker and ask her to come over and list their property for sale. I would think to myself, she just had someone call out of the blue and invite her to go make thousands of dollars. Why didn't they call me? It felt very unfair. I can remember when I was in my mid-20s and socially awkward. I would see men who could go out anytime and meet women and get dates. It felt so unfair that some men could meet girls anywhere, and I could only meet the feeling of fear and anxiety. Over time, I have learned that there's a deeper lesson in situations like these. I've seen that by making a commitment to learn for myself and by overcoming my initial emotional upsets, I could befriend and learn from people who got great results in life, and I could make the investment of time and effort to go and learn for myself. I also learned that most people who are successful in a particular domain are good people who like helping others. They aren't living their lives in order to stress other people out or make them feel inferior, and they will gladly help you if you show an honest desire to learn. I'm always on the lookout for a hidden benefit within an apparent pain, cost, loss, or stress. And in the case of exponentially increasing opportunity, what I've personally tried to do is use this experience to practice staying cool, calm, and collected in the middle of an increasing sense of chaos in many simultaneous life domains and in the face of increasing unfairness. As you probably know, in the center of a hurricane is the eye, where things are completely calm. Often, after hours of gale force winds, people going through a storm will hear things suddenly go quiet. They will look outside, and the wind will have stopped, and it might even be sunny and clear. What they don't realize is that the eye of the storm is passing over them, and that the wind is about to return, going just as fast, only in the opposite direction. This has led to many great tragedies, just like it does when someone standing on a beach watches the sea recede, not realizing that this sign precedes a tsunami. They often walk out into the space where the tidal wave is about to hit. But we can turn this concept around and transform the eye of the storm from a period of terrible danger to one of recuperation. If we're experiencing dramatic and stressful change or instability, we can remember that somewhere near the most intense part of the dynamic, there will be a calm spot where we can catch our breath, relax, and get perspective that allows us to master the challenge. I like to imagine that every tsunami has a type of surfboard that allows you to ride the big wave and move with its power. I live at the beach in Miami, Florida, and when there are storms, we will often see kiteboarders out in the wind and waves, cruising at car speeds, leaping dozens of yards at a stretch, and obviously turning the storm into an opportunity for radical enjoyment. Big wave surfers go even further. They watch the global weather forecasts, specifically looking for huge weather systems that will create huge surf, then will drop everything in their lives and fly to that part of the world in order to surf the monster 50-foot waves. This might sound a bit far-fetched for most people, but inside of each of us is a fearless warrior that can rise to the surface and take on the challenges that life throws at us. There's also a peaceful monk inside of us who can take a deep breath and meditate on the gift and miracle of life when necessary. Receive your gifts from the universe. A Zen monk was walking through the forest when all of a sudden a huge tiger appeared and began to chase him. Running away, he came to the edge of a cliff. He saw a vine growing down over the cliff, so he started to climb down. As he got out of reach of the tiger, he looked down and another tiger appeared below, growling. At that moment, two mice appeared, one white and one black. They began to chew away at the vine that the monk was holding onto. As they got closer and closer to chewing through the vine, the monk looked over and noticed a small plant growing out of the side of the cliff next to him with a single ripe strawberry hanging from it. He reached out with one hand to pick it and put it in his mouth. He closed his eyes. Delicious! Android Jones, the artist, has a painting titled Monarch Dragon. If you look closely, you'll see the outline of a child standing in front of the dragon, looking up to its face. Upon closer examination, we realize the dragon is made up of butterflies. When I am triggered by my wife and I've been upset with her over something, there's a moment when I start coming back and remembering that I love her and that our relationship is the most important thing in my life. Sometimes it takes a few minutes, sometimes hours, and sometimes days. But that transition always comes. If I can remember to notice my state right as I'm coming back and then consider how we got into the conflict in the first place, I always have a powerful insight. Your ability to do this in diverse situations in life determines much of your experience as a human. I recommend that you see and receive the gifts from the universe, even if there is a hurricane raging outside or a tiger growling at you. The ethics and morals of opportunity. We're about to cross over into learning powerful mental models for discovering and developing opportunities in our lives. As we leave the emotional conversation, this is a perfect juncture at which to discuss the ethics and morals of opportunity. As I've gotten to know brilliant opportunists in my life, I've noticed a pattern. Most of them seem to be unconsciously analyzing, estimating, and calculating opportunity in relationship to the benefit or return that they will receive individually. Most strong opportunists are not basing their mental equations primarily on the costs and benefits to others, to groups, to societies, to ecosystems, etc. They are unconsciously externalizing the bigger picture costs of the opportunity and internalizing the benefits without realizing that this is happening. An extreme version of this would be someone who destroys a natural ecosystem and plunders the resources so they can turn them into money and power for themselves. In the world of business and finance, This might be characterized by the selfish corporate raider doing a leveraged buyout corporate takeover, who buys a company and dismantles it to sell in pieces so they can make a profit. In extreme cases, there's no consideration of the effect on the people and families that depend on the survival of the corporation for income, or the loss of the benefit that the company provides to the world. I've come to believe that this pattern of only seeing benefits to self has its roots in a deeper level of animal-human nature. Once this pattern is better understood by society, it will serve each of us and all of us to help us achieve our values and purposes in life. Let's consider the conversation of ethics and morals from the perspective of personality type. In reading Ken Wilber's work, I was introduced to the dual modes of life and expression of agency and communion as first described by David Bacon. Agency is the impulse or instinct to assert or express self, to master the environment and world around you to achieve and become powerful. Communion is the intuition that the group or collective is the real entity, and it's the impulse to synchronize with others and serve the greater good. Some people seem natively oriented agentic, meaning that they see the individual self as the basic unit of reality in life. They see people as individuals who are separate, autonomous agents who have their own agendas. They tend to orient their lives based on their own survival, expression, and success. This archetype experiences a sense of success and fulfillment through their individual accomplishments and realization of independence. They think that everyone, quote, normal, unquote, is this way and should behave this way. They say things like, self-preservation is the first law of nature. That's Samuel Adams. In my study of this type, of which I am one, the key distinction is a sense of boundaries. They perceive themselves as separate at a fundamental level, and their psychological structure is about putting themselves and their needs first. On the other hand, people who seem to be oriented communal see the group as the basic unit of reality in life. This type experiences a sense of fulfillment through their relationships with others and a sense of belonging. They seek to help the group survive, express itself, and succeed. This type also feels that everyone normal is like them and all should behave as they do. They experience the group, the family, and the collective as their central concern in life. They tend to look at things from the perspectives of others as their main way of orienting in the world. Some research I've read suggests that these communal archetypes take a more holistic perspective. My experience with this type, of which my wife is one, suggests that they are naturally oriented to being a good member of their group entity, whether that be a couple, family, organization, or culture, for example, a nation, a religion, or a fashion. Of these two types of agentic and communal, some are extreme. Ayn Rand, an icon of individualism, or what we're calling the agentic type, went so far as saying that inferior minds had collective instincts and that a collective mind or entity doesn't exist. This is not uncommon with the agentic type. Many people are triggered and offended at the idea of a, quote, collective entity, unquote, or the idea that there's a group intelligence or entity existing beyond the level of the individual human or animal body. Gandhi was a powerful icon of collectivism, or what we're calling communion, or the communal type. He said things like, where there is love, there is life, and the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. This goes all the way to equating individual meaning and purpose with complete dedication and service of others. Science has its own version of what we're calling a communal paradigm. It comes from the evolutionary biological domains. They call it group selection, where the basic unit of evolution is the group. Or in multi-level selection, a more sophisticated model in my opinion, it considers multiple levels of groups and individuals as co-evolving entities. At their extremes, agentics tend to feel repulsion, revulsion, or even hatred for the other polarity. Strong individualist types are often willing to die before coming under the influence of a communal group or culture. Individuals sometimes risk going to prison because they don't want to pay taxes and contribute to the nation where they are a citizen. Magda and Joseph Goebbels killed their own children and themselves because they couldn't imagine their kids growing up in a society that wasn't National Socialist. And that's Nazi. Many people kill themselves by performing suicide missions for their causes or groups. Again, we're talking about extremes, but I see these anecdotes building a case for underlying agentic and communal types. Agentic types like to keep their opportunities secret. They use opportunity to benefit themselves. Many highly agentic types will take opportunity from others in order to have more, unconsciously and consciously. Communal types feel compelled to share opportunity. An opportunity for them is an opportunity for all of us, or for the planet. The communal type gives their opportunity away freely to others, unconsciously and consciously. As you consider opportunities in your life, I encourage you to look at them from both the perspective of self-interest and the perspective of collective interest. A great opportunity should ideally benefit you personally in a very meaningful way, and also be an overall contribution to social and ecological good. Avoid the trap of thinking that if something benefits everyone, then it also benefits you, or that if something benefits you, then everyone benefits. While these can be true, my experience is that they are sentiments that are typically used to camouflage obsessive or maladaptive over-identification with one of these two polarities that we're discussing. Frederick Bastiat said, "By virtue of exchange, one man's prosperity is beneficial to all others." I like to paraphrase sentiments like this one as, "The way to eliminate inequality, eradicate poverty, and save the world is to make me rich." These types of quotes are often used by selfish people who are trying to avoid contributing to the systems that supported their existence, life, and growth. So keep an eye out. As you consider an opportunity, ask yourself if it will contribute to the long-term health and wellness of all of the people that are touched by it. Ask yourself if it will contribute to their growth and evolution. Ask yourself if it will ultimately reduce suffering and help enlighten everyone. Will this opportunity make the world better? Will it help us become more evolved as a species? Will it put the planetary ecosystem into healthy balance? Will it encourage us to be our best selves and to make a world that works for you, the people you care about, everyone else, and the people they care about? Will this opportunity make my life better? Will it help me evolve personally? Will it put my life into balance? Will it encourage me to be my best self and make my life really work? As you work more consciously with opportunity across the different domains of your life, remember to be what J. Abraham calls an ethical opportunist. It's better to do something that balances the benefit between you and others than it is to do something that benefits you at the cost of others and the environment in the long term. I have a wise therapist friend who's often called by very wealthy people that are on their deathbeds. They call him because they need someone who can handle the intensity of what they're going through. When he arrives, they tell him how they're feeling bad because they lived their lives selfishly, neglected their families, were ruthless in business, and only considered themselves and their dealings. He looks at them and says, "Yes, and what would you like me to do about it?" When he told me this story, I was shocked awake from my trance of everyday life. My friend attempts to also offer comfort to these people who are about to die, but he made the clear point that the time to do something about this is in the beginning, not the end. My wife and I were talking recently, and she said something I'll never forget. She explained that our moment of death holds the potential to be either the worst experience of your life or the most exquisite. She said that if you have really lived to your highest potential, loved with all your being, and went for it, then the adventure of death can be your ultimate triumph. She uses mortality as the test frame from which to assess all current behaviors. This instantly changed how I saw my life and all my actions. The question that now accompanies me daily is, would my current behavior contribute to me having a happy and triumphant death? Look for opportunities that benefit you and that also benefit others. And check in with your conscience to feel your way through the complex opportunities that you will encounter in the coming years. How you approach your opportunities will determine a lot of how you ultimately feel about the value of your life. Reminder, get a summary of this entire book, plus written implementation exercises for every chapter, additional bonus sections, and access to a free class to help you discover your best opportunities by visiting opportunitybonus.com. The Emotional Opportunity Game. Too much opportunity can be shocking to the system. It can create a high cognitive load and overwhelm your ability to function. I call this opportunity shock. Navigating through an increasingly complex world of opportunity requires us to be more and more in tune with our emotions. If we're not attuned to our own feelings, they can hijack our thinking and influence us to do very counterproductive things. Feelings are actually complex combinations of feelings. By learning to name and differentiate specific emotions, we can get into better alignment and rapport with ourselves and manage our opportunities better. As you encounter more and more opportunity across diverse areas of your life, notice the feelings that arise inside of you. When you encounter stressful situations, remember that this is a part of the opportunity game and take deep breaths to center yourself. A few questions to answer as an exercise. Where have you felt opportunity shock in your life already? Where have you experienced the feelings of envy, jealousy, or FOMO? When you feel these emotions, where do you experience the sensations in your body? And do the sensations move or change over time as you attend to them? And what I'm suggesting here is by noticing where you're feeling the opportunity shock, by noticing the emotions, and then by feeling them through to completion, you allow yourself to have complete emotion cycles. And this refreshes, recharges, rejuvenates you, and readies you for the next opportunity.